Good evening, Your Excellency, Van der Werk. We are great to start, and before I start, I'd like to pay homage to the Buddha Flying the Sergeant and all that stuff three times. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. This evening, rather than a Dhamma talk, I want to consider this as a Dhamma lecture, as a Buddhist lecture. And the topic I'd like to discuss this evening is the role of compassion, especially in Theravada Buddhism. And I actually formulated the title and gave it to Ambassador, Her Excellency, Zhou Yimin. The formulated title is the underestimated power of compassion as an attitude. The understated power of compassion as an attitude in Vedanta. So I'm presenting compassion as an attitude, that we can use it as an attitude. I feel that we don't call on the power of compassion very often. The reason is that in Theravada meditation practice, we like to think that Vipassana meditation is the direct path to Nibbana. Vipassana meditation, inside meditation, the direct path. But when we talk about metta meditation, meditation on loving kindness and compassion, we think this is not the direct path, because it focuses on what we call conventional truth. In Pali, Sammuti Sancha, the Mudita. Because of this, in Theravada Buddhism, we kind of, if you like, we give as if it's, if compassion practice is the second grade meditation practice, we pass by the first grade. You know, we like to see that. I have seen it that way. But we all know, we all know this sutta, Metta Sutta, Karangian Metta Sutta in Sri Lanka. Every school child learns this in the school in Myanmar. The majority of the people know this by heart. I'm sure in Sri Lanka, in Laos, in Cambodia, in Thailand, in Cambodia also. People know that this is by far the most popular discourse in the Theravada Buddhist communities and countries. If you recall the sutta, at the end, Dittam Janam Isinowa Saya No Yawa Tatsangrikata Pitu Itam Satinka Dittaya Brahma Vedam Vihara Vidama. The last one, Dittinja Nupakama Silawa Dasanina Sangha. The first line, Dasanina Sangha No, is translated as achieving Sotapanna, that's the stream anchor. Sotapanna in Sri Lanka, Sowan. In Sangha Sowan, in Sotapanna, that's the first of the four stages of sainthood. Ariya level. Kamesu vinaya ketam nahi jantukapasetam. That one indicates anaka. So, matam. Hetya Raji in the Sadi Buddhism. So you don't need that, but Anagami is a the job, once you achieve a marga, simply simple mathematical terms, 75% of the job is done. Only one more step to go. This is in the metasutta, the Brahma Vihara, which includes compassion. So we very often overlook this point and underestimate the role and the power of compassion. Today I'm just briefly explaining that without compassion, in daily life, we are not going to be able to make sense of many. We are not going to be able to make sense of many. Some of the experiences that we face, if we see how some people are unkind, how they can speak unkind words, how their actions are less considerable, less considerate. When we see people behaving towards us like that, what we do is that we go into the survival mode, like Charles Darwin said, fight or flight. We either fight with them, we either fight with those inconvenient words, inconvenience, experiences. By doing so, we actually worsen the situation by turning it, by turning something which is simply an inconvenience into a tragedy. But inconvenience and tragedy are far different in terms of degree. But the way we react, sometimes it's a traffic jam. We're not talking about big, big crisis, a traffic jam. Sometimes maybe your boiler, break down and you don't get hot water. And the way you react to that, sometimes maybe your Wi-Fi is not working. Maybe you can't access your Facebook, you can't access your Twitter, your website. That's just an inconvenience. Okay, an inconvenience isn't a tragedy. But very often we react to that kind of situation as the best tragedy. We multiply the situation. This is, in popular terms, we call this EQ management, not IQ, EQ management, emotional quotient, that we are not able to regulate our own emotion, our emotion. In terms of the if you don't mind me recalling or mentioning the name of the Sutta, Satipatthana Sutta, the Discourse of Mind, this is about Siddhanta Dasa, about how the mind works, how we should deal with our thought, our emotion. Siddhanta Dasa. These days, of course, today I don't have any books with me. Usually I do keep my books with me just to show how these days clinical psychologists and neurologists, they have been using mindfulness and Buddhist meditation, not exclusively, but of course they also use the Hindu yoga and other forms of meditation, but mainly from Buddhist meditation sources. People like Professor David Richardson from Wisconsin University and before, or maybe almost the same time, Professor John Kabat-Zinn from Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the hospital, and asked them, people like Dr. John Teasdale, a psychologist from Cambridge University, Professor Mark William from Oxford, these people, they use meditation. And the book that they consider to be their Bible is by Venerable Dhyana Bodhika, the German born Sri Lanka, the Theravada monk who lived and died in Sri Lanka, in Kenya, the heart of Buddhist meditation. That book is, Mark Williams told me that it's his Bible. His Bible. Now, coming back to meditation, not just to compassion, I'd like to mention once again that traditionally, even in the meditation communities, among the Theravada practitioners, we actually downplay the role of compassion. So, coming back to using emotions, or using compassion, here, when I use the word compassion, I'm distinguishing between make and courage. I'm just using the word compassion in general, to embody the spirit of what we call Brahma Vihara, or Brahma Vihara, in Cambodian, Brahma Vihara. To capture the spirit from these four qualities, Dhamma Vihara in Burmese, in Burmese pronunciation, Dhamma Vihara in Sri Lanka, Brahma Vihara in Cambodia, maybe Brahma. Brahmi. And in Laos, Pomiha. Similar to Thai, I think in Thai also Pomiha. I'm raising this issue this evening that we actually underestimate it. We underestimate its use, its usefulness, its ability, can I use the word? Is this capacity to uplift our state of being? You know, we actually underestimate it. So, compassion as an attitude. Before I say this, I'd like to say once again, in positive opinion, if you have metta in your work, maybe as an administrator, as a government administrator, maybe as a business person, people would think that, okay, this is a weakness. Because they have a very naive notion of compassion. Compassion is about giving in. They have this notion of compassion. But no. When a child asks his parents for anything, do the parents give everything? Not everything. Because you're going to ruin the child by giving everything. You see? It's not a naive response. Compassion is not a naive response. But if we take compassion, if we try to understand compassion in the framework of the Four Noble Truths, the Four Noble Truths, in Burmese we call this Dhamma Dewa. In Thai, Ariya Satsi, I think the same in Ariya Satsi. It's singly Jadura Satjana, The third sati. The third sati. So that's insane. As you all know, the fourth truth. We can see here the way the Four Noble Truths is formulated. The first one, the Buddha talks about problem. He talks about pain, the attitude of pain that we have to face, and he also talks about the pain that we can do without. Two kinds of pain. The attitude of pain, that's involuntary pain, involuntary suffering, or some power to do. The power to do. Dukkha, in Thai we say dukkha, in Bali we say dukkha.
And it's like dukkha.
So, this circuit is this, the Buddha talks about this as the first item. The second one the Buddha talks about is causes. This is about understanding problems. The third one, this is the optimism that, also the positive outlook that this problem can come to an end, can be brought to an end. And then how to do that, then the solution. So we say, dukkha satya, samudaya satya, nirodha satya, magga satya. The whole aim is about reducing pain, is about reducing problem. So, the work of, the aim and the work of diplomacy is about reducing tension and increasing friendship, cooperation. If we understand it that way, I mean, I listened to, when I was unfair, I listened to one of the lectures by the International High Court Judge, Professor Veeramantri. Professor Veeramantri. He said, you know, the Buddhists are the first diplomats in the world who came because Emperor Ashoka sent his son and his peer from his country, Sri Lanka. And he considered that to be the first diplomatic mission in the world. The overall reason is to reduce pain, reduce tension, reduce conflict, all over the place. And to do that, what we have to follow is to recognize that there are problems. And to try and understand those problems. And then to remove causes. That will achieve this. And the way to do this is here. We have the eightfold path, the middle path. Majjhima Patipada. The middle path. Compassion should be considered as part of this, should be considered in this context. That compassion is aimed at reducing problem first within ourselves individually and then outside. Compassion, I'd like to stress again, is not a naive response. It's not about giving in to all the demands. It's about examining whether our actions, our thinking, can reduce the tension, the conflict, problem. That's in the spirit of dukkha niroda. Dukkha niroda. In time, in the mouth, thuk samuthai nirodh mark. In that mark, dukkha samudaya nirodha mark. The slightly different pronunciation, but we use the same word. We use the same word. Okay. Conclusion of my overall view is that when, for example, when the police have to arrest a robber, if they do this without anger, without intending to harm this person, I think they are doing this with compassion. Compassion because they need to prevent this person harming other people, the compassion of other people. If they leave this robber alone, he will get some revenge from other people who like to protect themselves. So in that way, they can also leave. Look at their work in arresting this person as being compassionate. If they are just intending to reduce problem, you see? So not many people think that people using arm, using weapon, have compassion. Last year, in the Buddhist Association of the British Armed Forces, they have certain once a year a conference. They ask me one question: you know, how can we do compassion? It's not possible when we are in the front. The opposite side, whether you call this enemy or the opposite side, has arms in their hand, and we have arms in our hand. And how can we follow Buddhist precept? My argument is that if you kind of keep in touch with your original objective in joining the armed forces, it's possible to develop compassion and ask them two questions. And so you can answer me whichever way you like. Okay, one intention is that, okay, you're going to the army in order to defeat your enemy, you just have your enemy in your mind. The second one is not that. The second one is that you know that your people, your citizens, need security so that in the morning they can send their children to school peacefully. Business people, they can go to work and do their business peacefully. Everyone, in every province, in every walk of life, so that they can go about their daily life peacefully. That is why you take and you join the police forces or maybe the armed forces, the army, the navy, the air force. So which intention brings you to the armed forces? This is the second, to protect the life and the property of the people. If you want to protect the life and the property of the people, this is compassion. This is compassionate-based action. You are not confronting your enemy all the time. You are just, most of the time, you are just preparing yourself to be better ready. So, if you don't forget your people, that you are doing this for them, you think about that problem which is in which is lack of security and lack of law and order. If you think of that problem, come the proper mind, they are hindered, but they will apply. If you think about this, you use the potential danger that might be fall on the people as your motivation. Now this motivation comes from compassion. It comes from compassion. Sometimes I had medical doctors, sometimes medical students, sometimes people who were training to be consultants, complaining about a very stressful time. I would ask them, why do you want to become a consultant? Is it because someone, your neighbor, from your neighbor has become a consultant and you want to prove that you also can be a consultant? This is competition. This is peer pressure. Or you want to become a consultant because you know that people who suffer from a certain illness that you are specializing in, you know those people, they are helpless. When someone is in the family, the whole family is in pain, is in trouble, in care. So you want, if you consider that pain and you want to help them, they are two different. One is for your personal glory. The other is for the happiness of other people. Which one you go for? Which this is your aim? If your aim is to help other people to reduce their pain and problem, your aim is actually praying over very compassion. You don't have the pressure, the stress of competing with your neighbor, with the people in your class. The pressure of competing is off. There's so much pressure of competing. The pressure from competition. And with competition as our mindset, deeply rooted in our mindset, even when we start working, we compete with each other and there's no natural cooperation. There's no natural cooperation. So, I think we can use dukkha, problem, pain, as a motivation. And to do that is compassion. Now, I'd like to make two more points before I open the floor for discussion. The first one is the scientific. The first one is the scientific discovery. This is whenever there is a decision to be made, whenever we have stress, we are at a crossroad. We can turn either way. There's a book called Buddha's Prayer. It's been translated into Thai also. I saw it in Bangkok. The Buddha's Prayer. Okay. Written by Rick Hansen from Buckley University of Taipei, Berkeley. And another book, The Emotional Life of Your Brain. That's accompanying Professor Richard Davidson from Wisconsin University. These people, they have been meditating, you know, for about 30 or 40. They have been meditating. Now they just meditate in their study, in their research. Their research. They say, under pressure, you can go either way. You can go into the green zone or the red zone. It's a red zone. They will do it. We have red zone. If you go into the red zone, it's water, chow down, say, fight or flight. You don't accept it. And you don't accept the problem. Fight or flight means you are using maximum energy. It's like a deer running away from a tiger. Okay. In order to stay alive, you use your maximum energy, you run. If you can't run away, you're going to use your maximum energy to fight back. If your deer is able to run, okay? How many times a day you can run? If you have to run many times, the second, the third, the fourth time, your energy is low. Your recovery rate is against low. You see? But this is for life and death situation. And the deer, one is escaped, has escaped from the tiger. Within the 5 minutes, 10 minutes, it can relax, drink water, start eating green grass. Human being can't do this. Stress at work, you take it home. Stress at home, you take it to work. People find it difficult to kind of heal, unlike those animals. Those animals, okay, yes, fight or flight, they are in this zone. But within 5, 10 minutes, they switch their zone and they go into the green zone. They relax. Their muscles become relaxed. They don't actually, the heart doesn't pump a lot of blood and the lung doesn't have to supply a lot of oxygen. See? With traffic jam that we face daily life in big cities like this. Before we reach work, if we go into the restaurant, but before we start work, we already exhaust the ocean. We already exhausted. So, this is in science what they call a method. And the green zone is hippocampus area. This hippocampus area is associated with calm, with correct decision making, with connection, connectedness. You're connected with the pain of someone sitting next to you. You can connect with the emotional stress, the distress that someone next to you feels. The amygdala is about disconnecting, being disconnected. You can't really feel what the other person is going through. Sometimes when parents are very stressed out, they can't feel that their children also have stress. They come to think that we as parents, we work very hard, we are very stressful. You the kids, you just have to go to school, you have an easy life, and still you're not. You're not working very hard. You know, that kind of complaint sometimes comes from the parents. the children highly very difficult to understand. The children cannot digest them. They cannot digest them. In Mandalay, the second city of Myanmar, a devotee of mine, of a family close to mine, close to me, that they have one, only in one time, 9 years old. He goes to three schools, in the morning to a Chinese school to learn Chinese, how to read and write and speak. And after he goes to IELTS, that's English man, speaking international school. Late in the evening, he would study Burmese, three school evening. And the mother, okay, would bring him food, and he doesn't have to go back he doesn't have to go back home. Instead, okay, he can eat in front of the just outside the school in the car. He can change also, you know, they provide him. The right moment, the mother would say, "Look, son, life is very stressful. I have to work, but I also pay a lot of attention to you because I love you. And so you should work hard. You're very lucky." She used the word, "You're very lucky." When she sees this every day, and she doesn't talk about the stress, the burden, the distress that the child has to go through every day, going to and running to three schools. One day, the child said, "Mommy, I'm not like you. You are like you. You don't have to go to school. And you have a lot of money." The child said, "If you do not read what the child is saying through emotional intelligence, through emotional intelligence, you think that that's no problem. But if you read from emotional intelligence point of view, what the child is saying, he's crying. He's crying there, okay? But me, you should also recognize that I have stress. I know you're stressed. You have a lot of distress, but I also want you to connect with my stress. We should be connected." He doesn't know how to say this, but what is it? It's different from what is preaching. So when you're in the grace of the mother and the child, they can connect with each other very well. Between husband and wife. Between neighbors, in the neighborhood, between countries. So it's very important that they don't go into the red zone, instead stay in the green zone. So green zone is associated with mindfulness, with compassion, when the red zone is associated with frustration, with rejection, with anger, with disconnectedness. So this is the psychology and neurological point of view. But the last one, let's talk about this one. Let's talk about the solution. In the Eightfold Path, we have understanding, right thinking, and so on. The eight, where is one may think that compassion doesn't feature prominently. It takes me many years to place compassion. Actually, it's very simple. I just would like to discuss the first 2 points. Sammatiti and sammasangha. Sammatiti and sammasangha. The the first one, samadhi, usually translated, is translated as right understanding. But I like to translate this as right attitude. It's the same. How right is it? Is that attitude? How right is an understanding? This is to see things in the context of the Four Noble Truths. In the context of the Four Noble Truths, right attitude. This is to see that in terms of problems are universal. When you go to work, when you see any traffic, when you face traffic, if you forget that other people are in the same situation, when you forget that this traffic problem is universal, when you forget that, it's very easy to become self-centered. It's very easy to make wrong judgment the driver, they can make very wrong judgment. They turn into different lanes and erratic driving behavior. So, a right attitude of samadhi is about seeing things as universal. Today it's a lot easier to see this because of the global warming, because of the digitization, because of the media. And we can look at the refugees problem. The other day we had World Refugees Day. We can look at this problem of one country impacts on another, or even in the wider world. So we can see dukkha or problem is actually universal. It's a lot easier if we have this in mind. And of course, for the last 70 years or so, things have turned into this way, that we see things in a more global manner, that we have many international organizations trying to promote this awareness. So, in other words, not to personalize problem to the extreme. Yes, we have problems, personally, but this problem has a universal aspect. So this is samadhi. Then what's the second sammasankappa? That's sometimes it's called right thinking. Here I like to use the word right. I would like to be a little bit provocative and use the word right emotion. The three definitions of right emotion or right thinking, sammasankappa. Not to have ill will, not to have a violence, not to have violent thought, not to have ill will thought, and to let go. Not to have ill will, this is to have metta, to have loving kindness. Not to have violent thought, this is about having karuna. So, unless we have compassion, actually, it's not possible to have sammasankappa. By this, I'm arguing that if we take the first two as banya, as wisdom, these two factors of the Eightfold Path, if we take them as wisdom factors, actually, this one is IQ, this one is EQ. IQ and EQ coming together. And in the EQ, compassion plays a very important part. We should even say it's vital part. Vital part. So with this, I'd like to summarize that. When we underestimate the power of compassion, and we don't recall that in our thinking, in managing our own emotion. Actually, we can become disconnected very easily with the people we work with the people we are, at different levels. To stay connected with the reality of the ever-present problem and dukkha, and to enhance our capacity to our capacity in managing it, in solving problems in daily life, we actually should use compassion as a demonstration. If somebody resents me, for example, it's very easy for me to put in the reason. This is not fair. Why you say this to me? You insulting me. If I go into the reason, I think my response can be, sometimes can be, I can make mistake, I can be unreasonable, I might even become aggressive. But if I stay in the green zone, my decision would be correct most of the time. If I need to call the police because somebody is insulting, it's okay for me to call the police. Out of compassion for myself and for that person, I can call, I can ask them to help from the police. But after the police have dealt with this situation, I wouldn't have trouble in my mind. This trauma is very, it is a very big issue. I don't want to go into this because we all know how big we pay, how much we pay attention to this issue in psychology and also in Buddhist training. Now, if I think that this person is actually suffering from something, that is why he is insulting. If I see him as someone who is suffering, who has problems, now, instead of getting angry with him, okay, I have compassion towards him. Of course, compassion also means another step. It also means solving this problem. How to do to prevent this person from saying me, how to prevent myself from being inflicted unnecessary pain. So, thank you. Any question? Anyone has any comment?
One thing I said that we have to focus your attention on the current political situation in the world and perhaps the technology, how the technology is working. Now, I was listening to a video clip today sent by one of my friends from Sri Lanka. Those days, at our time, a lot of time, the heyday is right, we used to write letters.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And now you send an SMS.
Mm.
So the emotions, immediately the emotions are being expressed. So I think the technology is not providing space for the people to think about and have tolerance.
Mm. Mm.
So I think it is somewhat conflicting with the, I don't say it is conflicting, but I think it is sort of a big hindrance in the present day social life, because the threat of divorce, the threat of crimes, all that is happening
suicide.
You take quick decisions without giving consideration. Those days, to reply, for instance, say a love letter, you take about 3-4 days to reply that letter.
Mm.
You try out several, expressions, and finally you conclude your letter and post it. Once it is reached to your partner, it takes a long time. They have a lot of time to think about it. But today, because of the technology, it has become a big problem even for solving problems. And I think it is aggravating problems in the society, particularly, you know, these technologies, communication technology. How do you think about it?
I agree with you entirely about your situation analysis. I agree with you. I think, if you don't mind me quoting a former British Prime Minister, Benjamin Disraeli, prepare for the worst and hope for the best. How do we prepare for the worst? From the very beginning of the world, look, this world, this life, okay, don't take it for granted. It has a lot of pitfalls. It has a lot of shortcomings. He uses the word that captured all of that, the word suffering. So, if we are not complacent, if we actually remind ourselves on daily basis, just about 2-3 minutes, remind yourself that the pressure that being that's being increased, that being, you know, multiplying by the social media, by the technology, with this, we already expect the worst. If we expect the worst when it actually comes, we are not surprised. There is no surprise factor. Sometimes we get caught up by surprise. And when we get caught up by surprise, the reaction comes from our subconscious, not from conscious. Not from conscious. And the subconscious mind is likely to use the amygdala resources rather than the hippocampus. So, again, if we go to, this is from the, as you know, from the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first sermon. The second sermon is saying the same thing. Second sermon, look, this physical body can fall ill anytime, meaning don't take it for granted. If you remind yourself everything like this, you're going to be ever more compassionate to yourself. The mind can also be, it's a very stressed out. Okay, what the Buddha say? Even your memory can even trouble you. So if, I mean, in terms of past, I mean, if we remind ourselves this way, I think we are well prepared for the worst. We do really need to prepare for the worst. And once we have done that, now we are able to manage the situation and then hope for the best. This too, number three, number four, is about hoping for the best. Yes.
So I don't know if you're going to agree with this or not, but a couple days ago I read a report that said that they did studies on meditation and people who meditated for long periods of time for many years, and what they found was that their ego increased substantially.
Mm-hmm.
So I first of all want to ask you if you agree with that, but secondly, is that good or not good?
I don't know, you know, how we define ego here. If you take ego as self-confidence, I would agree with you. But if you think ego as being self-centered, I don't think if a proper meditation, meditation has many qualities that we need to develop. Especially, you know, here, the Eightfold Path. I'm talking about developing attitude, I'm talking about developing emotion. Okay. Two of the eight factors. I think if we develop, if we pay attention to these factors, and increase the ego in terms of self-confidence, yes. A an increase in terms of being self-centered and being disconnected with other people. I don't think.
May I ask another question?
Yes, please, please.
Yeah, I think during the period when Buddha was living in India, and you were referring to the militaries and the various kinds of armies who trained to, you know, protect the country and can interfere with the ladies because of the compassion that took after the property and the people will really do that. But I think there were some instances where the princes of various kingdoms used to join Buddha. They came to the priesthood, and there were complaints from the king saying, how are we going to protect the country? I think this is a particular example. And thereafter, Buddha decided that if a prince is joining the bhikkhuhood, and he should get permission and so forth. So there were consideration even within Buddhism. This is not a question as such, but as a comment. But what I'm trying to say is, even Buddha recognized that the protection of the country and protection of the people and the property is part of the whole life. Right? He has given serious considerations of that, kind of point that we think. Now, if you take the recent political development, how do you look at that with North Korea and United States? Is it something to do with compassion without going venturing into war, giving some consideration and trying to solve the problem, you know, as you said, the Four Noble Paths, right? Whether it could be, analyzed. I think there is something lacking, Reverend Sir. We don't analyze the real life situation as Buddhist, for the Buddhist monks or any other religion. We should analyze and, you know, publish certain things and say that this is how it worked, right? But there's something lacking, the gap between what is happening in the real world and what is the religion. I'm not only referring to Buddhism.
I think I agree with you. You know, we need some public discourse in this. I agree with you that we don't discuss the Dhamma in terms of its application to daily life, in terms of like even international politics, international affairs. Now, North Korea, America, I think people who have developed nuclear weapons, and even in chemical and weapons, maybe they develop them, you know, with the aim of using them as a deterrent. This is what I have in mind, which is just for protection. So far, people with nuclear weapons, we can separate these biological and chemical weapons. The nuclear weapons, they haven't used them. They know better than us, you know, what kind of destruction it can cause as a duke. Knowing this, knowing the danger, I think also knowing the cause of killing, going through that armed race at that speed, how he called them. This might bring them that this might have brought them together. So I still would see this in the frame of the following truth. They see the problem, the danger, and they try to apply some solution. Even in terms of SWOT analysis, in business analysis, you know, threat and weakness, you know, they see this and they try to turn this into that opportunity, not individual opportunity, but for both sides. If we, I don't really know the detailed discussion, but reading journal from papers, I think both sides are willing to kind of sit down and go further. So this is a very good good. Going back to what you command on the Buddha's time and the armed forces for protection, yes, in the Akanya Sutta, the reason that the Buddha and thereby Buddhists see why we should have a government and armies and we need security. Security of our life and security of our property. And we need some people to work on this full time. So as in terms of social contract, so people who are being protected, they would give taxes, and the government would protect them. So this is in the Akanya Sutta as before. So we call this, if a philosopher from Oxford, John Russo, he would call this social contract. Social contract. This is in the Akanya Sutta. I must thank you that I studied very all this in Sri Lanka. because I never looked at the Sutta this way before. Of course, I further this at Oxford University. Yes. Any more questions, please?
Yes, sir. I would like, if I am allowed to,
please,
another reply to him.
Yes.
So, first of all, I remember very well when my mother said, before you send a letter, sleep one night, then read it again the next day. Yes? So, now, when we have this technology, so someone is giving us this technology, but we must also update our moralities, our psychological attitude towards it. So we must, means that I have no children, but if I had children, I would teach them, never take decisions when you are in an emotional state. Never send any SMS when you are full in anger. Just wait and see. Just wait a couple of hours. So we must set ourselves these rules, because it's a big temptation to send someone an offensive word. So, in very practical terms, we need new rules to live better with this technology. Otherwise, it will kill us and destroy. This one Sri Lankan co-founder of a program of Facebook, it's a difficult name, maybe it's the Tamil, but he said he very much feels guilt of having participated in the programming of Facebook, and we are going to destroy the fabric of how society works. So we need to very much consider these dangers.
And I think we are going beyond that point. There was an answer that in some countries like China, they have not allowed the Facebook to be operated in their territories because they value their culture and their own social fabric. So that is one way. But I think in case of other countries, quite open to others, and they have opened everything. But even in Sri Lanka, we had 101 problems because of the Facebook, criminal defamation, character being done. So this one is the act of crime. So this is happening, unfortunately, can't help. But I don't know whether, Reverend Sir, you are talking, analyzing the Dasaraja Dharma, which is something very important for today's political leaders, I suppose.
Actually, lately, I examine the this is the 10 duties of the rule, but his excellency is a refraining. Recently, I had re-examined this one, and again, from EQ point of view, the majority of them have emotion capacity. Not angry, not getting angry, but being connected, being patient, all those things, they are all about EQ capacity. It's amazing, you know, how the Buddha kind of saw this as being very important.
How do you think about the other religions? Now, let's say the Christianity, or Hinduism, and let's say Islamic. You know, all these religions, you know, we are Buddhists, you know, because we believe in you. I was born as a Buddhist, because that reason I became a Buddhist. Not because of real understanding, but now I realize that is one of the way, better way of, you know, life and you know, how to conduct yourself. But what I am saying is, even other religions, you would have done in the university about analyzing, see how I think there are some similarities and kind of things, so that every religion is in some important aspects.
I'd like to focus on something positive. I'm verified a student of positive psychology in a new discipline where the Buddhism and also other religions have contributed a lot to his development. I think all religion is about it's teaching, you know, how to look beyond you. How to look beyond you. In Christianity, okay, the way they teach, not just Christianity, in all the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, it's about looking beyond you and then connect with God. And then look at everyone as a creation of God. So this is about connecting. If you can connect to the pain and suffering and also the joy of other people, you can never harm them. Right, in Ramadan, when people observe fasting and holding, the aim is to understand hunger and the people in poverty, the people disadvantaged, you know, in life in some way. Then, when you can connect with them, actually, you know, you become a better person. In the same teaching of Islam, Judaism, Christianity, and Judaism, of course, it has adopted a lot of the earlier two religions. Hinduism is, of course, with Buddhism, we share a lot. For them, is in their theology, individual soul and cosmic soul. There's Atman and Brahman. Individual soul, that says yourself, you know, how you see yourself, how you want to be in your life. This is to simplify it. But you should actually look beyond this. Cosmic soul. And once you come to see that, there is no difference between individual and cosmic soul. Meaning, there's no difference between your pain and the other person's pain, both are in pain. Whether you come from Washington or from Pyongyang, let's say, and your pain is the same. When you come to see this, actually this is about the connection between individuals and cosmos. I mean, to apply this to politics. So we do have all these positive points in all religions. But if we tend to look at the differences, we become disconnected. Maybe one last comment and question.
I have a comment, but I spent a lot of time in Burma.
Okay.
And if you travel around, especially in the tribal communities, there's a lot of animus.
Yes.
Beliefs,
yeah,
that go hand in hand oftentimes with Buddhism. So it seems that for the people every day, they have trouble just living to the level that they're expected to as Buddhists. So all these different animus spirits help them get through the day.
Mm.
is that, why is that?
Actually, lot of study have been done in this area, not just in Japan. Actually, in Thailand, you will see even some of this. And it is elements also in Sri Lanka. You know, we have next to the Buddha shrine, you know, we have the other shrine also in the Devadaya, for example, in Sri Lanka. So we do have that kind of thing. Then there is a compromise that Buddhism always does. Wherever it goes to the country. In China, it compromises with Confucianism. In Japan, with Shintoism. In Japan, with all religion. In Tampa, in Bukan. In the about 1,000 years ago, there were 28 in the time sects of animism, groups of animism, and people believe in their own local god. And they don't mix, they didn't mix. That was very difficult to King Orata when he came to the temple. And at one point, he I think he might have gone into the press, so he banned all of them. Banned all of them. There is a place where all the stages of those deva, those cultures are kept. It's called Natthama. Natthama, that's the prison of the of gods. He actually built a prison for. And then people couldn't understand it. Actually, people couldn't digest that. And they revolted. So he compromised that, okay, in Buddhism, we recognize heavenly beings, the devas. They are, okay, we can use the word angels. They are angels because they have these qualities. Those positive qualities. And yes, I accept your 36 gods, small g, but this one is superior to all of them. It's called Sangha, that's Indra. Sangha. So he added another one, 37. And today we have in India 37 gods, those are economy. 37. This has political history, this has spiritual history, and the people accepted and they became united as a country. So you have everything in it. People started trading with each other, people started socializing. So that was
happening. You should do that with North Korea.
Yes. I share with you blessing just for what is we just would like to invoke the blessing of the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha on all of you, and to thank you for being here this evening, and also to invoke the blessing for your long life, good health, and all the success in whatever you do. Sadhana, 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 Sadhana,